Tribe says recognizing Cooper and the tribe as allies is timely as the U.S. prepares to observe the 250th anniversary of the signing of the Declaration of Independence. The coin depicts Polly Cooper with General George Washington as she holds a basket of corn. Cooper stayed at the camp through the winter and taught soldiers how to prepare corn and cook for them in harsh conditions to help ensure their survival. Oneida Indian Nation Representative Ray Halbritter says the Oneida people became America's first allies on some of the bloodiest battlefields of the Revolutionary War. According to the tribe, nation members continue the legacy of military service, serving in every major American conflict since then. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Glad to have you with us here on the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, January 29th, 2026.
This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes
Althea Billings and Isabel Charlet.
The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto.
Our director of evening news is Althea Billings.
Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth, up next.
Listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. ICE agents have continued to target the Twin Cities in Minnesota, and local communities are organizing in a variety of ways to push back. KBOO reporter RC was on the scene Wednesday.
I'm at the corner of 26th and Nicolette Avenue at the Alex Preddy Vigil, and this is Wednesday, January 28th, and I have these three people who are going to share their name.
Lenora Moore.
And I'm Hoa Trin.
Okay, and I stopped these folks to say, what does it feel like to be out here tonight, or what brought you out, or what's moving for you?
Well, it was emotional for me just to be at the place where this happened, and I honor Alex, you know, as a nurse, and his dedication to come out and to be an observer, to help the immigrants and people in our community. And when he was doing a good deed and he was helping the ladies that he was shot, and I just wanted to come out and honor his life, that it was not done in vain.
Thank you.
I think his death was really hard because it really hit home, being a nurse and as a community of nurses. It was just really hard to see him being murdered for trying to help another person in need. And I think I'm here to just, you know, honor him and his life and his goodness. And, you know, as an immigrant, a child who came here to the States, and as a nurse, it's just it's very touching when you know, Alex, who's a Caucasian male, decides to stand up for people who needed a voice and needed support. And that's why I'm here, because I have other friends that came here to honor him, and I think we're here to show how much we love and appreciate his sacrifice during this time. Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah.
Do you want to share anything?
As a nurse, I think this, like what Hoa and Lenora said, is just for a man who does a job that takes care of others, and just for this tragedy when he was simply trying to help someone, I think is just devastating. And just as fellow nurses who just care so much for others and, you know, give our time and effort, I think being here just to support him and then the cause to honor him, I think was just really important to me.
Are you surprised by how many people have come?
No, not at all. Well, and we were just, especially nurses. And as nurses, we were just talking about how we can more like serve the community just with, because we have so many kids, because we work for the St. Paul School District, that are shut in out of fear. And so, I mean, just never in a million years would I think that I'm packing groceries and diapers for families that are too afraid to go shopping and leave their homes for fear of them being snatched. We've already had some students that have gone home to parentless houses because they were taken during the day, and we've had siblings that have been forcefully removed and are lost. And so I think it's just how we can help, you know, support those families that, you know, can't go to their doctor's appointments or get their meds, just those common everyday things that used to be such a simple thing is now, I mean, they have to think, is it worth it? Like, worth my life of, you know, either dying or being taken from my family? It's just tragic.
That's an important big question.
Yeah. In both the school districts, I mean, Minneapolis and St. Paul have really seen how it's imprinted their kids. So it's heartbreaking.
40% of your students are at home.
All three together.
Okay, I'm here on 16th Street. I'm here with
Alex.
Can you describe what just happened in the last few minutes?
Yeah, I woke up this morning. I live not on this block, but quite nearby, and saw a message on our community thread that ICE was present on this block here. And so I threw on some socks, threw on my boots, threw on my jacket, and ran over here. We know that ICE agents who are here in Minneapolis don't like having eyes on them, don't like community observing what they're doing. And so when something is happening this close to my house, I try to just step outside and witness. So when I arrived, I saw multiple ICE vehicles kind of blocking the middle of the street, probably 5 or 6 agents who were out of their cars, and I saw them shining a light in the window of a neighbor's house here on the block. I think they were pounding on the door. And there were already one or two neighbors here who were making noise and filming. The agents were acting really aggressively. So one neighbor who was standing way back from where they were conducting their operation, but who was filming, 5 or 6 of the agents got in a row and just sort of charged at him, threatening him for filming what they were doing. So I stayed out here whistling, witnessing, filming for a few minutes. And as I stood, more and more neighbors came out. They heard what was happening. While I was here, I didn't see ICE take anybody. I'm not sure what happened before I got here, but eventually they drove off. I think they realized that they had too many community members, too many eyes watching what they were doing. And they were really aggressive towards all of us. All of us were just doing fully legal activities of observing, filming, witnessing, whistling, letting our neighbors know. And they tried to intimidate all of us, but we all stuck around and they didn't. So that's our pre-7 a.m.
It's our pre-7 a.m.
Yeah.
How do you feel right now?
I feel scared that they got somebody before we got here. And I feel, I'm so tired of them being here, you know? This is like such a terrible way for our neighbors to wake up, you know? My friend stepped out and had to go back inside because I think her kid had gotten woken up by all the sound on their street. And yeah, it's just whether or not they got somebody this time, that's just so, such a violent way to interact with our community here.
Is there anything else you would want people who would listen to this to know about the response network or what it's like to be here?
You know, I think we are seeing the very best of what people can do and the very worst of what people can do on display every day here. You know, I saw dozens of my neighbors come out in the sub-zero temperature this morning to drop everything they're doing and witness and try to do what we can to keep one of our neighbors from being taken. And that is so beautiful to see. And everybody, this is in Minneapolis right now, and everybody in the United States needs to be preparing for if this comes to your community. And the best way to do that is just to be building relationships with each other.
I'm on the corner of East Lake Street and Bloomington Avenue, and I have
Deborah Larson.
Okay, and Emily Newberg. Great. And we're out here. It's about 6 p.m. or something, and it's the Line the Lake Street protest. What brings you out tonight? What do you want to share?
Well, we're here because, of course, we have to keep coming out. We need to be out here more than they're out here. This action in particular was put together by a coalition. What makes Minneapolis so great is that we have many coalitions. We have a lot of different organizations. We have a lot of different just actual cells of people working within neighborhoods. And we have formed coalitions pretty much over like 10 years, honestly. And then in 2020, of course, we really kind of perfected the whole system. So in a way, we were kind of prepared for this.
Yeah.
And so this action is a coalition, and I'm part of one of the organizations that's in that coalition, and we said, come out, line Lake Street with our message, and just be present.
Great. Yeah.
And we are, I mean, we are a sanctuary state. That we're known for that. And so we have always supported our immigrants here, and we've always been proud of that. And this is like a huge kick in the stomach, the biggest insult to our intelligence, to our humanity, that they dare to come in here and start, you know, deporting innocent people, killing innocent bystanders.
Right.
They are criminals. Yes. They really are.
As we can hear, it's just nonstop.
We get a lot of good
nonstop horns. Yes. There's people on all four corners with amazing signs. So is there anything you would want people to know about what the mainstream media might not be covering?
I'll be honest, I'm not exactly sure what mainstream media covers because we've become so used to not depending on that.
Yeah.
But what I hope they know is that everyone is involved. Like, everyone is involved. The number of people you see on the street is a fraction of what it takes for what we're doing to get rid of this occupation. We've got people taking care of families while other people are out. We've got people just dealing with normal life stuff. We've got people patrolling neighborhoods. Everybody is doing something. So it's just, it takes, and doing mutual aid and delivering food to families that can't come out. So it's just, there's all these ways to get connected. So when this comes to you, just know that there's a role for everyone, but it's important that everybody get involved. It's almost impossible not to.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
And you were saying that this is a big immigrant neighborhood.
It is,
you want
a big,
to say
huge
more
community.
About it?
It has many different ethnicities of immigrants that have businesses and live in this area, and they have been literally terrorized. A lot of the businesses have had to close down because the employees they don't dare come out to work. And so they're losing thousands of dollars and their livelihood.
Is there anything else you'd want to share that I didn't ask?
Well, ICE, obviously. This is a national thing, you know.
Yeah.
We hope people can see that we can fight this.
Yeah.
They're leaving. We're winning. You know, Bovino's leaving.
We see that as a win. Yeah.
And we are breaking them down, and I think that the nation watching us is just going to make it more difficult for them to do it to the next city.
I'm still on the corner of East Lake and Bloomington Avenue, and I have
Miss Abdi.
Okay. And what are you doing out here tonight?
I'm here. I bring tea and sambusa, some bread for the community, because we stand for together as a Minnesotans to help each other, and ICE needs to be out. So people, they're protesting for as a Minnesotans, I just came here to share with the tea, and because this weather, it's sacrificing for people. So I'm so happy to see a lot of people outside. So this is what only I can do for the people.
Okay, and yeah. Have you been coming out every night?
Yeah, most of the time.
Most of the time. And what kind of tea are you serving?
It's Somalian tea, Somalian simbus, and Somalian bread.
Oh, how wonderful. Is there anything else you'd want to share to the people who might be listening?
The only what I will say to the people, stand together no matter what.
No matter
yeah.
what.
And be proud. And I'm so proud all Minnesotans, they are together. Yeah, I'm so happy.
Thank you.
No matter what we color is, no matter what we believe, we are here. You can see here.
That was KABU reporter RC reporting from Minneapolis. This is KABU News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Stay tuned to KABU. The Global Citizen International Digest is next.
Welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest with Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. It's critical commentary on foreign affairs from a human interest perspective. The opinions expressed in the following segment are those of the speaker.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Global Citizen International Digest. I'm Mel Gertov. I'll be reporting and commenting on the most important and sometimes the most neglected international news of the week. First, Trump's dispute with Canada escalates. Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney's powerful speech at the World Economic Forum in Davos, which drew a standing ovation, overshadowed Trump's rambling presentation, perhaps prompting the president's angry turn to retribution. Carney made waves by portraying Canada as a middle power that prefers, quote, partnership over domination. The speech was an appeal to other countries that are looking for a third way, a pragmatic foreign policy not tethered to one or the other major power. Trump retorted that, quote, Canada lives because of the United States, a ridiculous statement that Carney pushed back on by proclaiming, Canada doesn't live because of the U.S., Canada thrives because we are Canadians. Trump is determined to make Canada pay, literally, for its independence. He threatened 100% tariffs on Canadian goods entering the U.S. if Canada should conclude a trade agreement with China. But Canada's recently concluded deal with China is merely a quid pro quo. Chinese EVs entered Canada's market in exchange for Canadian agricultural products entering China's. Moreover, Canada previewed that arrangement with the U.S. trade representative, after which Trump said, good for him. But now Carney is, to Trump, Governor Carney, another enemy on Trump's lengthening list. Another Trump administration move guaranteed to worsen relations with Canada is a crude effort to encourage separation of Alberta province. The Treasury Secretary, Scott Bessent, said Alberta is a natural partner of the U.S., a crude effort to appeal to a small separatist movement there that is seeking to get on the ballot. By most accounts, Alberta citizens want neither separation from Canada nor absorption by the United States. India's surveillance state. India has invaded private life in a way no democracy has attempted before. The Washington Post reports that, quote, over the past decade, the Indian state has quietly assembled a parallel digital security architecture that allows authorities to intercept, analyze, and store communications data at an enormous scale. The official justification is that the system prevents fraud. A recent study by the United Kingdom-based research firm Comparatech puts India near the bottom of its rankings of how a state protects the privacy of its citizens, with only China and Russia faring worse, unquote. The latest government move in India sought to require phone manufacturers such as Apple and Samsung to pre-install an app that links with SIM cards, allowing the government to access call logs, messages, photos, and network information. That demand was rescinded after an intense public reaction. But India's government still has Aadhaar, a near-universal biometric identification system that links fingerprints and iris scans to banking, welfare benefits, tax filings, mobile numbers, and private platforms. In effect, the Washington Post reports, Aadhaar has become a master key to everyday life, enabling the state to map identity, behavior, and access across sectors. The government also uses the Israeli-designed Pegasus system, which embeds a spying device in phones. Governments worldwide have used that system to spy on journalists and opposition politicians. Under Joe Biden, Pegasus was rejected in the United States, but it thrives in India. The U.S. further distances itself from NATO and Europe. Donald Trump's militant stance on Greenland is just one sign of his administration's disaffection with NATO. His agreement on a framework for resolving the Greenland crisis calls for a sovereign U.S. military presence on the island and as yet unspecified mineral rights. Though the deal will not alter Greenland's status with Denmark, it is doubtful that Trump has let go of his desire to buy the island. Nor is it clear that U.S. forces will cooperate with other NATO units on Arctic defense. At the Davos meetings, Trump belittled NATO for failing to support the United States as much as the U.S. has supported NATO. He cited Afghanistan, suggesting that British and other NATO troops avoided the front lines. In fact, Britain, Italy, and other NATO forces lost hundreds of soldiers in the only war in which NATO invoked its collective security commitment. British politicians of every stripe denounced Trump's remark, forcing him to reverse gears and praise the British contribution in glowing terms. Trump also got into an argument with Britain over its decision to cede the Chagos Islands in the Indian Ocean, site of a U.S. military base, to Mauritius. Trump said the decision was, quote, an act of great stupidity. British Prime Minister Sir Keir Starmer caved in to Trump's criticism and reversed his decision. One last example. The Pentagon has announced that the U.S. will be withdrawing about 200 military personnel from nearly 30 NATO advisory groups. These groups are concerned with energy security, naval warfare, and intelligence, among other functions. Last year, the Pentagon announced it would withdraw a brigade of troops from Romania and cut security aid programs to the three Baltic nations that border Russia. Under laws passed by Congress last year, the Pentagon must consult with it if U.S. forces in Europe go below 76,000. They're now around 80,000. All these events have put Trump in the crosshairs of Europeans. Other than pro-Trump Hungary and Serbia, NATO and European Union member countries have all determined that they can't rely on the U.S. and must pursue European interests independently. One early example, a major trade deal with India, January 25th, that will slash tariffs on most goods, reducing reliance on the United States. This mother of all deals, said India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi, is expected to double EU exports to India by 2032, leading to savings of 4 billion euros, that's around $4.75 billion, in duties for European companies, according to the EU. At least one U.S. official is peeved. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said, quote, the U.S. has made much bigger sacrifices than Europeans have. We have put 25% tariffs on India for buying Russian oil. Guess what happened last week? The Europeans signed a trade deal with India. Exactly. Wielding tariffs the way Trump has costs. And those costs will go much higher if the EU decides not to complete a trade deal with the United States. In other news, U.S.-based multinational corporations get a tax break. As though their profits aren't large enough, the Trump administration has orchestrated a deal to enable U.S.-based multinationals to continue moving earnings into low-tax countries, thus enhancing their bottom line. Finding these tax havens has always been one of the many options uniquely available to multinational corporations, and now American companies have an advantage others do not. The administration strong-armed the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development to weaken a 2021 regulation, which the Biden administration initiated, that requires all multinationals to pay a 15% global minimum tax on transactions involving tax havens such as the Bahamas. Trump had threatened to impose a retaliatory tax on foreign investors. The Treasury Secretary, Scott Bessent, hailed the new agreement as, quote, a historic victory in preserving U.S. sovereignty and protecting American workers and businesses from extraterritorial overreach. How the Trump administration punishes pro-Palestinian opinion. Chris Hedges writes about the Trump administration's persecution of Francesca Albanese, the United Nations Human Rights Rapporteur on Gaza. It's a sordid tale of constant efforts to silence and sideline her as she investigates and reports on Israel's genocide. Says Hedges, quote, she was placed on the Office of Foreign Assets Control List, that's OFAC, of the U.S. Treasury Department, normally used to sanction those accused of money laundering or being involved with terrorist organizations, 6 days after the release of her report, From Economy of Occupation to Economy of Genocide. That report cited 48 corporations and institutions, such as Lockheed Martin, Microsoft, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, IBM, and Caterpillar, that had profited from the Israeli repression. It also includes a database of around 1,000 corporations that collaborate with Israel and demands that these firms and institutions sever ties with Israel or be held accountable for complicity in war crimes. Hedges notes that by being on Trump's OFAC list, not only is Albanese denied rights normally granted to UN officials, financial institutions are prohibited from having her as a client. And this companion story, how Israel's Netanyahu seeks to punish a liberal newspaper. Sometimes Benjamin Netanyahu outdoes Donald Trump in efforts to silence critics. Israel's leading liberal newspaper, Haaretz, reports that the Netanyahu government has ordered that all ministries cease contact with Haaretz. In an affidavit filed with the High Court of Justice, the government says the newspaper, quote, has expressed support for the enemy in time of war, and therefore the state was under no legal or public obligation to support it financially. The affidavit also said Haaretz is, quote, used by many of those who hate Israel and anti-Semites on a daily basis. In fact, the only thing Haaretz is guilty of is criticizing Netanyahu's politics and policies. Coal is rebounding under Trump. As the U.S. retreats from regulations to combat climate change, it also is giving new life to the coal industry. In 2025, the Rhodium Group reports, 13% more coal was burned than in 2024 for electricity, helping account for a 2.4% increase in U.S. greenhouse gas emissions. A major reason for the increased electricity use is the construction of more and more data centers using AI. The economics of burning more coal at existing power plants has led some utilities to postpone planned retirements of coal plants and others to stay open beyond their planned closure. In the latter case, that was due to an order from the Energy Department. The goal is to stop the political closure of coal plants, said Chris Wright, the energy director, a goal in keeping with Trump's beautiful clean coal assessment. There's a major problem here, however. The costs of keeping these old coal plants open can be staggering. These are old plants, and they are expensive to refurbish and keep open, said Ari Pesco, director of Harvard Law School's Electricity Law Initiative. The costs, he said, are going to fall on somebody. The question is whether it's the plant owners or the public. The death toll from the Iran protests is uncertain. Early reports from Iran estimated an exceptionally high number of deaths as Iran's security forces fired into crowds in a desperate effort to halt protests in some 400 cities and towns. These estimates ranged from 12,000 to 20 or even 30,000. Iran's government eventually said around 3,400 people were killed, including 2,400 civilians and security forces. But the U.S.-based Human Rights Activists News Agency puts the death toll at 5,137, based on activists inside Iran verifying fatalities against public records and witness statements. Among them were 4,834 demonstrators and 54 children. China purges a top military official. General Zhang Youxia, long considered a confidant of Xi Jinping and a vice chairman of the powerful Central Military Commission, which is equivalent to our National Security Council, has been placed under investigation. Considering the closeness of the two men, this is an extraordinary development that leaves the seven-member Central Military Commission with only two members, Xi plus one other. The other five commission members have all been cashiered. Zhang was the only CMC general with combat experience. China announced that another general, Liu Zhenli, not a commission member, was also placed under investigation. As usual, details of the purge have not been published, only that General Zhang was removed for, quote, grave violations of discipline and the law. Ordinarily, that charge might signify corruption, but in this case, many observers believe Zhang had challenged certain Xi policies, or that Zhang might have been a factor in the eventual succession to Xi. These purges, the latest in a long list of Xi purges of the military's top ranks, indicates serious problems in China's military. A new study details the extraordinary costs of the Ukraine war, especially for Russia. U.S.-Russia-Ukraine trilateral talks are taking place in Abu Dhabi. Some reports suggest the parties are very close to an agreement, but Russia's public position suggests otherwise. A Kremlin aide said that, quote, without resolving the territorial issue, there is no hope of achieving a long-term settlement, unquote. Resolving the territorial issue means that Ukraine must give up land to Russia. In this four-year-old war, a study by the Washington-based Center for Strategic and International Studies finds that total Russian and Ukrainian casualties is nearing 2 million. Since February 2022, says the study, Russian forces have suffered nearly 1.2 million casualties, more losses than any major power in any war since World War II. The study reaches two other important conclusions. First, that Russia is paying an extraordinary price for minimal territorial gains. And second, that Russia is becoming a second or third-rate economic power. Its manufacturing is declining, consumer demand is weakening, inflation remains stubbornly high, and the country faces a labor crunch. Economic growth has slowed to 0.6% in 2025. That's the Global Citizen International Digest for the week. I'm Mel Gertov. Thanks for listening, and take good care.
To KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO.